This is Radio Parallax, a slightly different perspective from a slightly different view, with topics that include matters in science, technology, history, politics, current events, and whatever we damn well please. And now the host of Radio Parallax, Douglas Everett.
Let's begin today's program by acknowledging the good work done over at the Sacramento Bee. We've had a great relationship over the years with the Bee, and we commend them, in particular their reporter Camila Pedrosa, for her recent piece under the headline, "Student-run UC Davis radio station wants to keep its underground charm as it moves above ground." And featured in the piece very prominently is our very own KDVS liaison, Guy Tortorici. Yay. It's a fine piece, and we look forward to actually speaking with Guy directly about his role in the article and about the whole piece in general and KDVS's move, which has supposedly been in the works for 10 years now, allegedly because Freeborn Hall is seismically unsafe, which personally, I believe, was a bunch of malarkey cooked up by one of the previous chancellors who, shall we say, did not have a reputation for honesty. And that's all I'm going to say about that. And of course, Guy's already given you the disclaimer about how any opinions you hear on this program don't necessarily represent that of, well, God, anyone else. At any rate, we look forward to discussing that article and the situation at Freeborn Hall and KDVS, etc., in a future installment of this program. On last week's program, we mentioned that we wanted to do some current events. We were pretty full on last week's show using some clips from YouTube from, as I believe, David Pakman and Ben Mycelis, augmented by our live talk with our favorite lawyer, Stephen J. Harper. We look forward to speaking with adjunct professor of law Harper soon, real soon, maybe next week or the week after. On the second half of today's program, we're going to do what we did last week. We're going to go to YouTube and pull off another person who's doing a fine job of keeping track of what's going on in the political scene. In this case, Brian Tyler Cohen, who's doing a great job, by the way, of keeping track of political events. We think that we would do well to simply take what he's doing and amplify it, repeating it for you if you didn't catch it on the first installment. I know that he has a book coming out in the near future, and maybe he will even come and speak with us directly. We hope so. We're also going to make an effort to reach out and grab Joe Connison. Mr. Connison's been doing some fine reporting for the past few decades. In his recent book, The Longest Con, How Grifters, Swindlers, and Frauds Hijacked American Conservatism, something we'd really enjoy speaking with him directly about. We did play a clip of Mr. Connison talking about some of this stuff, I guess, last week. But it'd be better if we could speak to him directly. We're going to see what we can do. If we have time today, I'm going to also quote from The Longest Con, because he's got some great, great stuff in there. Meanwhile, back to current events. A friend and sometime listener alerted me to the fact that on CNN, they were taking a look back at 1968. My friend suggested that I check it out, adding that you probably know all this already. And I have to confess, I haven't checked it out because I'm pretty sure I do know all of this stuff already. But my God, what an eventful year, 1968. I think that that's the only year in recent times, I mean, recent generations that compared to this one in terms of just the bizarre topsy-turvy nature of it, including an incumbent president saying he wasn't going to run. Back in 1968, that was Lyndon Baines Johnson. And of course, now it is our current president, Joe Biden. A frequent contributor to this program, Donald Rose, also contacted us to comment about the fact that J.D. Vance is, according to the polls Don pulled up, the most unpopular pick for vice president ever. And, well, we'll have more to say about Mr. Vance momentarily. But I do think I need to explain something from last week's show where I made the comment to Stephen Harper about J.D. Vance possibly being dumped from the ticket by Trump if Trump thinks that it'll be to his advantage. I made the statement, shades of Thomas Eagleton. For those of you who are too young or simply don't remember, Thomas Eagleton was originally the choice of George McGovern as his running mate. But politics being what it is, and dirty tricks being what they are, someone did some digging and found out that Tom Eagleton had had an episode of depression in his past, for which the psychiatrist treated him with electroshock therapy. This caused quite a furor, and in fact caused George McGovern to remove Eagleton from the ticket and replace him with the future First Lady of California, Maria Shriver's dad, Sergeant Shriver. This was the time of Watergate and epic dirty tricks run by the Republican Party, which contributed to McGovern being swamped in the general election in 1972. I'm very pleased to note that we did have the opportunity to speak with Senator McGovern about some of those episodes. And if you didn't catch that, please check it out on our website, radioparallax.com. We were able to speak with NPR's senior political analyst, Daniel Shore, in conjunction with George McGovern. And I have to say, I don't think we've ever had a finer moment in all of our radio adventures. Anyway, out of the 20th century and into the 21st. Although, frankly, sometimes I'd like to go back, but I can't do it. The Electoral College is pretty interesting at the moment. Michigan and Wisconsin appear to be leaning to Harris, meaning that the election is going to come down to Pennsylvania, Nevada, and Arizona. In fact, it's going to come down to Pennsylvania. The polls at the moment have both parties at 251 electors. Pennsylvania happens to have 19. And the winner-take-all method of choosing our presidents state by state, that's going to do it. Winning Nevada and or Arizona ain't going to make no difference if you lose Pennsylvania. Anyway, I think we said on our last week's program that it's really a matter of our civic duty, I think, to address what's going on politically. This is not a political show. It's sometimes a political show, but it looks like right now we need to kind of make it an almost full-time political program for the next few weeks and months. Now, as we see it, the psychopath who should be in an orange jumpsuit, incarcerated, but in fact is the Republican Party nominee for the presidency, continues to do what he does best, which is just lie and make unfounded personal attacks. No sooner was Kamala Harris elevated to the top of the presumptive Democratic ticket than Trump sharpened attacks on her. He called her a bum, crazy, and a radical left Marxist, saying that if she wins, the American dream is dead. World leaders would look at Harris, the first black woman to lead a major party ticket, and, quote, walk all over her, unquote. That's Trump on Fox News. To which he added, I don't want to say why, but a lot of people understand it. Now, one of the clips we're going to do in our second half of the show today is one that's based on what it could be the key to defeating Trump that Trump himself is telegraphing to the public, which is the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025, an amalgamation of what, the wish list of what the Republicans wish to accomplish under a second Trump administration. Some of these proposals are, shall we say, raising eyebrows. Project 2025 calls for strict abortion restrictions, immigration raids, and weakening job protection for civil servants. It's so far out there that Trump himself is repudiating them. Yes, the orange psychopath himself has dismissed the 2025 recommendations as coming from, quote, the severe right, unquote. Apparently facing attacks from both Donald Trump himself and the Democrats, the Project 2025 director, Paul Danz, announced this week that he would step down. He, of course, will be replaced by the Heritage Foundation's president, Kevin Roberts. And we'll have more to say about that in the clips in our second segment. Another prelude to those clips will be the fact that, we've been talking on this program for quite some time about what the plan is to subvert the 2024 election. We're pleased to note that a lot of other people are now on board, including Rachel Maddow, who starts out one of the clips aired by Brian Tyler Cohen. Spoiler alert, it doesn't really matter what the vote count is. Trump operatives are going to step in and call the election into question, whether it's in a county or a number of counties, or eventually for the whole state. This really was the plan in 2020. But of course, the whole thing being organized by Donald Trump, it all went to hell. But they're back. Just as one example of what we're up against down in Arizona, Carrie Lake, a former local news anchor and MAGA enthusiast, won the Arizona Republican primary for the Senate seat being vacated by Kyrsten Sinema. Carrie Lake is a first-class election denier. When she lost the race for governor 2 years ago, she tried to sue everybody that she could think of to claim that it was all voter fraud. Well, she lost all of those. But believe me, all is not well in Arizona. Now, a lot of attention is being paid to the battle going on in Silicon Valley. The Week magazine called it the Silicon Valley cage match, featuring Donald Trump's supporters led by Tesla and SpaceX chief Elon Musk and venture capital heavyweight Marc Andreessen being opposed by the equally loud and defensive swarm on the left, including LinkedIn co-founder Reid Hoffman and top venture capitalist Vinod Khosla, who are now rallying around California's own Kamala Harris. Now, at first, I was feeling very good about the fact that some people in Silicon Valley are going against the grain of the Peter Thiels, who, by the way, gave us J.D. Vance. J.D. Vance has been manipulated by Peter Thiel into various jobs and really, and I'm quite certain, into the vice presidential nomination. And personally, we hope he stays right where he is because he's helping. But I do want to note with some sadness that the reason that the Silicon Valley liberals are vocally backing Harris is because Harris has been described by the New Statesman as arguably being the most pro-Silicon Valley of any major party candidate ever. Lily Lynch, writing in the New Statesman, said, "The Bay Area native seems more amenable to working with rather than against her hometown industry." Paul Bradley Carr, writing in the San Francisco Standard, said, "She has not attacked the crypto industry or called for revoking liability protection for tech giants." Oh, her brother-in-law, chief legal counsel for Uber. But keep in mind that for a while, J.D. Vance was a venture capitalist operating out of Silicon Valley, thanks to Peter Thiel. Writing in the L.A. Times, Ann Kolkas said, "Trump has exploited the fissures in Silicon Valley by choosing J.D. Vance. Vance has the unequivocal backing of tech leaders who unapologetically assert principles of techno-libertarianism. They are looking for someone who will minimize tech regulation." Well, except of companies that are too threatening to their own interests. The Financial Times noted that Harris may win back the Trump-curious tech crowd, but if she's not to alienate her own party, she should be careful of siding with billionaire donors trying to dictate policy. Boy, you'd have to see that, wouldn't you? Billionaires trying to dictate policy. Anyway, let's just take a moment to drill down a little deeper into J.D. Vance. Even the Wall Street Journal, that bastion of, I guess you'd say, conservative hogwash, was not too happy with the choice of J.D. Vance. They took a look at the fact that last week, with Kamala Harris surging in the polls, a 2021 video surfaced of Vance calling Harris, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and other prominent Democrats, quote, "childless cat ladies who are miserable at their own lives," unquote. And that was not a one-off. Riffs on childless cat ladies have been a staple of Vance's public comments for years. And here's the part I like best. He has even referred to childless Americans as, quote, "sociopaths," unquote. And proposed that they pay higher tax rates. While parents should be given an extra vote in elections for each child. And no, these are not the statements of somebody residing in a rubber room. These are statements of a United States senator who's the Republican Party's choice to be the vice president come election time. Politico notes that the Ohio senator has a bunch of weird views on gender. These are rooted in the, according, they felt these were rooted in the new right's deep skepticism about modern feminism and gender equality. Vance is adamantly opposed to abortion, even in cases of rape and incest. In the Senate, he voted against a new rule that would prevent law enforcement in anti-abortion states from getting access to women's medical records. He's also opposed no-fault divorce, arguing that people in unhappy marriages should stay together for their kids, even when the relationship is abusive. Writing in The Bulwark, Jill Lawrence said, like Sarah Palin in 2008, Vance has violated the first do-no-harm rule of Running Mates. And instead of going after Harris, Republicans this past week were on cleanup duty, with Trump explaining on Fox News that his Veep pick just loves family. Meanwhile, doing his part, Vance kept digging a deeper hole, insisting in an interview that Democrats are anti-family. New York Magazine noted that Trump may be stuck with Vance. It would be technically feasible for Trump to dump him from the ticket, but doing so would anger the white nationalist dudes of the MAGA base who love Vance, precisely for his outlandish views that make him controversial to normal people. Mr. Millen points out that it's not all peaches and cream with the far right when it comes to J.D. Vance, because after all, he married a Hindu. Even worse, they have a kid with a Hindu name. The Nation magazine noted that as a venture capitalist, Vance has been cultivated and promoted by Silicon Valley's creepy pro-natalist movement, which includes tech billionaires Elon Musk and Peter Thiel. These patriarchs are encouraging procreation, by the right people, of course, to improve the human gene pool and to minimize the need for immigrants in the workforce. These notions may sound strange to normal people, but the really terrifying fact about Vance is that he is deadly serious about this. I don't mind mentioning this is one of our pet peeves on the program. Morons out there who think that we need to increase the world's population, even though global warming, depletion of resources, and eco-catastrophe goes hand in hand with the fact that we have an excess number of people here on the planet. Don't mind reiterating that when I was born, which wasn't that long ago, but I confess it was during the Eisenhower administration, there were 2.5 billion people on planet Earth. There's now close to 8. With three times the number of people we had on Earth just 60 plus years ago, it seems near impossible to avoid catastrophe. And yet, the J.D. Vances of the world and Peter Thiels of the world and Elon Musks of the world are saying what we need to do is procreate more. We need more humans. And of course, economists are expressing, you know, much wailing and gnashing of teeth over the fact that they don't know what to do about the fact that if the population doesn't continue with that great pyramid at the base that tapers up to the top, what will become of society? They don't know what to do. In exactly the same fashion that they all admit that the GDP is a terrible way to measure well-being and prosperity, and yet, that is what they inevitably rely upon to make comparisons between nations and between then and now. And by the way, Stephen Harper mentioned something on the program last week which I was not fully aware of, but I stumbled upon it in The Economist. Apparently in a speech on July 19th at the Republican National Convention, Donald Trump thundered, "We will drill, baby, drill." Encouraged by rapturous applause, he warmed to the theme, vowing to boost domestic production of fossil fuels to levels that nobody's ever even seen before, making America so energy dominant that it will supply the rest of the world. The Economist notes that Trump was assiduously courting oil bosses. In April, he invited a group of them to Mar-a-Lago and promised to scrap what they see as President Joe Biden's onerous regulations on the industry. He only asked that they contribute some money to his bid for re-election, in this case, $1 billion. He apparently argued that the figure would be a bargain compared to the windfall they'd receive from lower taxes and looser rules, which is probably true. A little stat which I can't quite put my hands on at the moment is that at the moment, the U.S. is producing more oil than it ever has before. And, well, so much for the peak oil discussions we had on this show 15 years ago. There were estimates 20 years ago that oil production would peak at 2019. But thanks to fracking and other high-tech methods, they're now saying it may peak in the 2030s, the late 2030s. Of course, in the meantime, that means more oil production and more fossil fuels being burned. And I want to take a detour out of this and some stats at the moment. Starting with the fact that, according to the Washington Post, the four hottest days in recorded history all took place a couple weeks back. The global average surface temperature reached a record 62.7 degrees Fahrenheit on Sunday, July 21st. That's according to the EU's Copernicus Climate Change Service. That record got broken on Monday when the average hit 62.89 degrees. Tuesday then became the second hottest day on record, and Wednesday then tied Sunday for the third warmest. And, you know, the national debt has gotten much worse thanks to the fact that Republicans keep cutting taxes but don't seem to ever get around to cutting spending. According to National Review, the U.S. national debt this week surpassed $35 trillion, with a T, for the first time in our nation's history. This milestone comes after the national debt surpassed the $34 trillion threshold for the first time last January, and the $33 trillion mark that took place in September of last year. If you're keeping score, it took 192 years from 1789 to 1981 to accumulate the first $1 trillion of national debt. We now stand at 35. And yes, this goes right back to Ronald Reagan and the Republicans cutting taxes, but not cutting spending. You know, say what you want about Bill Clinton. He actually, by the end of his second term in office, got the increases in the national debt close to zero. Now, there's a famous old saying that I felt bad because I had no shoes until I saw a man that had no feet. Now, I'm not sure we've ever subscribed to that less bad equation, but it is possible to look around other countries and see that, well, it could be worse. Jacob Zuma, the criminal that used to be the head of the African National Congress and the president of the country, last week got expelled from the ANC as punishment for his backing of a new rival party in May's elections. That populist party, the MK, ran on a platform of seizing white-owned lands and redistributing them to the black majority. It won an unexpected 15% of the vote, diluted the ANC's support, and contributed to the loss of its parliamentary majority for the first time since apartheid ended in 1994. Zuma was forced to resign as president in 2018 following a series of corruption scandals. So the difference between South Africa and America is, apparently in South Africa, if you're corrupt, they may remove you from office. Furthermore, the party you're affiliated with may then repudiate you. We think it's a useful model. Meanwhile, down in Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro stole an election. Election observers feel that the opposition candidate, Edmundo Gonzalez, probably won something like 70% of the vote in Venezuela. But wouldn't you know it, when the votes were officially counted, it turned out Maduro had 51% officially, whereas Gonzalez only managed to get 44%. Now, Maduro and his party have pretty much wrecked the Venezuelan economy. More than 7 million Venezuelans have fled abroad in recent years, seeking a better future. The United States, the EU, Chile, and Colombia have all called for a full and transparent vote count. That's a forlorn hope. But Cuba has congratulated Maduro on his victory. But then Cuba is not noted for its free and fair elections, or for feeling that there's any need to hold them. We don't want to be the first to suggest that as he looks forward to how he might want to run his election, Donald Trump might want to consult with Nicolas Maduro. But let's just say we wouldn't be surprised if he did. Anyway, that nation that served as a role model for Venezuela, Cuba, apparently is imploding. Turns out that the central planning and state control down in Castro land at this point is unable to provide even the basic basket of goods for its people, let alone much of anything else. This has led to growing inequality, unrest, and emigration. In the last 2 years, a tenth of the Cuban population of 11.2 million has fled the country. Any of this makes me feel better. But then again, maybe it does. I made friends on one of my multiple trips to Cuba many years back and can report that at least one good friend did manage to get out of Cuba and into Florida. And yeah, as bad as Ron DeSantis is, he's probably an improvement on Raul Castro. We need to take a short break. Let's do that. You're listening to Radio Parallax. I'm Douglas Everett. We got more politics and maybe a little bit of science coming up, so stick around. Narcotics.